Hi there, Dr. B here with your Module 1 clarifying lecture for EDSC 619. Just so you know, I will always be recording these as one big lecture for all the sections because I believe that this information probably will help everyone. I'll start with some general information, I'll talk about your discussion boards and videos, and then I'll get into your inner teaching. And then I'll answer whatever questions you have. So some general information, make sure that you are meeting with your inner teaching group. You must meet with your inner teaching group. This is a requirement and is not optional. You must meet with your inner teaching group. So make sure that you're getting in touch with them, that you're working at a time, and that you're getting together to answer the questions. There was some discussion. I hope I've clarified it so far. Inner teaching and the reading discussions are two separate assignments. The inner teaching, you have to meet as a group. The discussions are done on your own time. You'll be posting two video summaries and asking an open-ended question that's supposed to generate discussion amongst your group. And when you're not supposed to be doing those video summaries, you are talking amongst yourselves within the group. Now, to clarify that too, if you are posting a video, you still need to participate in the discussions. So just because you posted a video doesn't mean you're off the hook for those two posts. So make sure that you have both. Fluency quizzes look great. It's the highest I've seen in a while, so I'm very happy about that. Thank you so much for your hard work on those fluency quizzes. And also thank you for your patience. I know that this clarifying lecture comes a little bit later than I'd like, and that we're still grading some things from Module 1. Unfortunately, Michelle, we had a family emergency and she was not able to work with us. So we brought in some fabulous people this term. We have Rhea, Michelle, and Scott who will be helping us out. And please be patient and gentle with them as they get up to speed. You may be wondering why we are so strict with these terms. Who cares if you are using the term positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement correctly? Who cares about reward versus reinforcer? We use these terms all the time interchangeably. Doesn't really matter, right? Well, it does. One of the reasons is because of that big old exam that has that 65% pass rate. You want to make sure that you're answering questions correctly. And some of these definitions and terms have very small nuances that can either make a question correct or incorrect. But also think about it in terms of when you're using these principles and procedures. If you know the definition, you're more likely to be using them correctly. If you start getting loose with the definition, you may apply it very incorrectly. So think about it in terms of when you have these concepts down pat, then when it comes time to use them, it's that much easier and you can have more confidence that you're using them correctly. As an old martial arts teacher once told me, if you know a technique, you know one technique. If you know a concept, you know 1,000 techniques. So that's the reason why we are so strict, and we'll keep being strict about this stuff. All right, let's talk a little bit about your videos. Looks like a lot of you are local this time around. That's a little bit more unusual. We usually have people from several different areas, but it's nice to see all of you. When you're putting your groups together or you're meeting with people, do keep in mind those time zones, please, that some people will have different availability based upon what time zone they're in. I'm happy that a lot of you are interested in things other than autism. Always happy to have autism practitioners, of course. You know, that's a very, very important part of what we do. But ABA is so much more than that. We can use it. I'm starting to use it in health coaching. We can use it to increase appropriate workplace behavior. We can use it to help ourselves in a lot of ways. So it's nice to see that that's getting a bit more recognition, mostly because this course is going to be more of a why course as opposed to a how course. And what I mean by that is that you're going to learn those theories and principles that make up our science, as opposed to how to use them with a certain population. Because again, if you know a principle, you've got 1,000 techniques for 1,000 populations. So keep in mind that as we move through. Now let's talk a little bit about your inner teaching. It looks like a lot of you are off to a really good start. We were all very impressed by the inner teachings that we've been grading so far. Remember that you want to have more than just a bullet point or two. We're seeing a few that answered questions really quickly and probably a little bit more hastily. Good answers are usually 1 to 2 paragraphs, and those paragraphs are usually more than 3 sentences. So make sure that you're looking at your book, you're looking at your resources. We will expect you to be using the things that you're learning in this module in your inner teaching. So you've got to draw in the stuff that you're learning in order to answer the questions. It's best to answer as one group as opposed to being individuals. So I do like to see the color coding to make sure that you all are participating, but you want to come up with one big cohesive answer. Now, there's going to be times when 2 people may disagree on something, and what I want you to do is note that and ask for clarification. You're not going to get points off if 2 people are disagreeing and you're asking for clarification. You will get points off if you're using terms and things like that incorrectly. I know you all know this, but grades are cumulative over the term, so you can earn 10 points per week. Occasionally, I'll get shocked emails. I only got 10 out of 80. What did I do wrong? Nothing. You can only earn 10 points per week. So don't worry about it if it says 10 out of 80, that's actually correct. So let's talk about some of the things that were in this inner teaching this week. Let's talk a lot about this free will as it relates to behaviorism. So behaviorism is considered deterministic in nature. I would never, ever, ever tell anybody what to believe or religious beliefs or things like that. But it's important to understand that in the world of behaviorism, free will doesn't really have a place. So for those of you who are more accustomed to free will, it says that we are free to choose what we do, that it really has no influence per se. It's, truly philosophically free will means that we have absolutely 100% control over our behavior and the environment doesn't influence it at all. Determinism says that what we do is really in response to what other things are going on in the environment. So the environment determines our response. That's why it's called determinism. So in behaviorism, it's all about, what happens before and what happens after influence our responding, and we tend to make choices pretty logically based upon those environmental determinants. So we really are much more deterministic in nature. Now, to be fair, Skinner and a lot of other prominent behavior analysts were pretty staunch atheists. And so the idea of free will as it relates to religion really wasn't something that they were pondering per se. So, but again, I'm not going to tell you, to give up your religion for behaviorism or anything like that. I'd never do that. But just something to keep in mind. Why do we call this a science of behavior? Why is this a natural science as opposed to a quote unquote soft science? The reason is because we're looking at the environmental events that influence behavior. Now, those environmental events can happen all kinds of places. So they can occur outside of us or outside the skin. So that would be things like the way other people behave. That can be the way animals behave. That can be biology as it relates to weather. It can be just about anything that would influence our behavior. There's also those determinants that can happen inside the skin. What does that mean? That means anything in our biology is fair game to be either an antecedent or a consequence to our behavior. Now, does that mean that our thoughts drive behavior? No, it means that our thoughts are behavior. So when we're thinking, it's not a logical progression from antecedent thought, behavior, consequence. And that's why we say that you don't have to quote unquote understand or be able to explain reinforcement in order for it to have an influence on your behavior. Because it may be that you don't have words to describe it, but it's still influencing. So thoughts and feelings really are more byproducts of these contingencies than they are influencers. There are times when thoughts and feelings can start to become influencers, but that happens much later. We'll be talking about that later on in the semester. I always like to ask the question about the magic of behaviorism because I had a colleague say that they really were not big on behaviorism because it makes things so dry, mechanical, it takes away the magic of development. And that, you know, our reliance on data, our reliance on science, our reliance on biology, it makes things kind of, in their words, depressing. I always thought that the changes that we can make in people's lives is, you know, nothing short of miraculous to me. You take data, you see patterns that emerge, and you can come up with strategies that either strengthen those patterns through reinforcement or break those patterns, either through reinforcement or punishment. And so to me, that's magical. To other people, it might seem more dry or more methodical, but I'm assuming that you're here because you agree with me, hopefully. But you may or may not. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about precision in our discussions as it relates to Module 1 stuff, and a little bit of Module 2 as well. So I want you to make sure that you're being very careful about how you use the term reinforcement. There's no such thing as reinforcements. That's like calling the cavalry type of thing. When someone says, I use the reinforcements, I always think about, you know, somebody like riding in on a horse with M&Ms or something like that. Don't use that term. Reinforcement is a process, not a thing. And you'll learn that more as we get into Module 2. So reinforcement is a process, not a thing. We will be starting to take off points for that. And reinforcers are the stimuli involved in the process of reinforcement. So please do not use the reinforcements or the punishments. I know that Skinner and some of the other writers that you're going to read sometimes fall over into that category, but it's important that we are more precise. Also, be careful of using the terms reward and reinforcer interchangeably. A reward is something nice that you give somebody when they do something nice. It has no influence on the future probability of a behavior. You can reward somebody and they will never, ever, ever do that behavior again. However, a reinforcer strengthens a behavior. And sometimes I'll tell the analogy, I'll probably tell it again next week, that let's say you have a table that you bought at a flea market. It's seen better days. It's a little wobbly. And it's sagging a little bit in the middle. What are you going to do? Are you going to paint it a bright pink and say now it's happier? Or are you going to get some boards, shore up the middle a little bit underneath, maybe get something to prop up the one of those legs that maybe is a little bit more wobbly so that it's stronger? That is reinforcement. So it's the difference between a reward is just painting it pink and making it pretty. A reinforcer is something that strengthens it, makes that behavior stronger, and makes it more likely to occur in the future. And it may not be so pretty, but it does the job. I also want to talk a little bit about explanatory fictions. And this is another one where I do a lot of analogy and metaphor. But in explanatory fictions, basically what we're doing is that we're assuming mental processes that may or may not be occurring, that we cannot measure, we cannot say for sure. So what's an example of this? So we might say something like, it's clear that he needs to control his anger. We don't know for sure if somebody's angry, nor do we know if when they say they're angry, that those events that are happening under the skin are identical to ours when we get angry. There's no way that modern science can measure that right now. Even with an fMRI, we cannot measure those types of things. We're making an assumption about somebody's mental state. We're making an assumption about what they're thinking. We're making an assumption about their feelings. And you can't do that. You gotta go by what you see, what they say, what you can measure. So if someone says, I'm angry, you can say, they said, I'm angry. But you can't necessarily say they are angry. I just said, I'm angry. If you look at my facial expression and things like that, it doesn't match. If you hear my tone of voice, I don't think it matches. So we use all of those things to start making assumptions about internal states. But in fact, you have no idea. Am I angry? Am I not angry? I could be livid with y'all right now. I'm not, by the way, but I could be. And there's no way for you to be able to know for sure. That's what an explanatory fiction is. I sometimes use, I call it the Ms. Frizzle test. I don't know if you remember the magic school bus from back in the day, but Ms. Frizzle would, she was an elementary school teacher who had a magic school bus that would take her children on all kinds of adventures. And sometimes the magic school bus would take you inside the body. So the magic school bus would shrink and it would go into somebody's ear and it would ride around the body and she would be explaining what was going on inside the body. If you would need to be Ms. Frizzle and you would have to shrink your magic school bus, go into somebody's head in order to confirm what's going on, that's an explanatory fiction. You can talk about your own stuff that's going on under the skin because you can confirm it, but you can never confirm other people's. That's the difference. That's what an explanatory fiction is. Hopefully I've explained that well enough that I'm going to see everybody avoid them throughout the semester. All right, let's talk a little bit about your questions. There is a question where somebody was asking for more examples of motivating operations. I'm going to say hold that thought for a little bit because we're going to be getting that into much more depth with that later on in the term. And if you still have questions at that point, then ask it again. But right now, have a general idea of what a motivating operation is. And that is something that makes that three-term contingency either more powerful or less powerful. That's enough for now. We'll get more in-depth a little bit later. What is a practical application of philosophic doubt? That's a great question. So first of all, what is philosophic doubt? Philosophic doubt is when you're presented with new information that contradicts the information that you once had, that you drop the old information and adopt the new. So let's talk about practical applications of philosophic doubt in history. One that comes to mind for me is I used to work for a place called Children's Seashore House. And it's a rehabilitation hospital in Philadelphia for young children. Why is it called Seashore House? It's a really weird name, right? It started on the shore of the Atlantic, so in New Jersey. Children with tuberculosis would be taken to the Seashore House because at that time, doctors believed that salt air coming from the ocean will cure TB. Now, experiments come along, things come along, yada, yada, yada. We find out that, no, that's not in fact true, that TB is a microorganism and it responds to, I believe it responds to antibiotics. I'm not a doctor, but that salt air has nothing to do with it. That would be philosophic doubt. Philosophic doubt says, okay, you know what? Let's forget the salt air and get them antibiotics. In our sense, in our behavioral sense, if there's a body of research that absolutely contradicts even the most, you know, ingrained principle of behaviorism, then if that body of literature is convincing and it's well-done science, we got to throw out that one piece of philosophy and adopt that new principle. And there's a lot of things that we did even 25 years ago when I started that we don't do anymore because we've received new information about either A, how to do it better, B, that it wasn't as effective as we thought it was, or C, that it actually ended up being harmful. So that's what philosophic doubt is that you don't do the same thing over and over and over again because that's how we always did it. Hopefully that helps answer your question. And then the last one is methodological versus radical behaviorism. So what are the differences between the two? I like to think of radical behaviorism. Now, everybody thinks radical as in terms of like, you know, like over the top or something like that. But it actually doesn't mean that in behavioristic terms. In our case, radical behaviorism means that these contingencies of reinforcement and punishment that determine our behavior on the outside. And they do, you know, reinforcement and punishment. You know, our behavior responds logically to the stimuli in our environment. Reinforcement and punishment are processes that are involved with that. And that these processes work outside the skin as well as inside the skin. So if you remember earlier, I was talking about thoughts and feelings and how their behavior too, and how they are subject to the three-term contingency, they're subject to antecedents, they're subject to reinforcers, and that there are behaviors in and of themselves, not necessarily causal variables. That's what radical behaviorism really espouses. Whereas methodological behaviorism is a bit more wary of those things that are under the skin. So it's a bit more of the outside environment. Whereas radical behaviorism says they thoughts and feelings exist, we just can't measure them unless they're our own. All right, so hopefully I've answered all your questions. Thank you for listening, and whether you've watched the video or listened to the podcast, looking forward to seeing you next time.